Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. Like most Montanans, especially those who immigrated into this region in the early settlement days, Granville Stewart was a complicated man. Stewart ended up in the Idaho Territory by mistake after spending several years traveling back and forth from Iowa, where his family had settled, to California or Oregon, where he and his father and brother James were among the hundreds of men who tried to make it rich during the early gold rush. It was during one of Granville and James's journeys from Oregon to Iowa that Granville fell ill in what is now Idaho. James stayed behind as the rest of the group continued their travels. By the time Granville recovered, it was winter, which meant they couldn't resume their journey east. So they agreed to spend that winter with a trapper friend named Jake Meek near present-day Dillon, Montana. This fateful turn of events became the catalyst for a long life in Montana, where Stewart played a role in almost every burgeoning business enterprise in the state, befriending many of the most influential figures in Montana history, and also participated in one of the darker chapters in Montana's past. Stewart kept a journal, which was eventually turned into a book called 40 Years on the Frontier, and the details he shared about his experience became invaluable and often hilarious. Chapter 1, Wanderlust. Granville Stewart was born in 1834 in Harris County, Virginia, a county that would become part of West Virginia after the Civil War. When Granville was four, his father briefly moved the family to Illinois when they created the Iowa Territory and homestead claims opened up there. Robert shuttled the family to West Liberty, Iowa, in a region where the mosquitoes were so thick that the water had to be drained through cotton cloth to weed out the larvae. Stewart shared that Erastus Yeager, one of the boys in the one-room school that he attended, grew up to be one of the men the vigilantes hung in Montana years later. Iowa served as the home base for the rest of their parents' lives, but Robert was always on the hunt for a big payday. So he was among the score of men who traveled to California during the 1849 gold rush. He returned 2 years later after having very little success. But just a year after that, he packed up Granville and his older brother James and headed west again, this time to Northern California, where they spent another year prospecting before Robert decided he'd had enough. He returned to Iowa. The brothers decided to stay in California, and for the next 3 years, they roamed the California-Oregon region searching for the big payday. That never happened, which was why they finally made the decision to return to the family home in Iowa in 1857. In Granville's book, he records almost daily entries about this journey, and the conditions were brutal. One entry tells of them traveling longer than usual one day because they couldn't find any water. They spotted a lake in the distance, so they made the extra effort to get to the lake called Honey Lake, only to find that the water was undrinkable, which makes you think the name was probably not suitable. Most of the entries from this journey focus on water, grass for the horses, or the rocky conditions of the road, which must have been very hard on the horses. On July 17th, after being on the road for just over a month, where they had traveled about 600 miles, Granville became very ill. This was when he became so sick that the rest of the crew, which numbered 11, decided to go ahead because it was clear Granville would not be strong enough to travel even when he got better. James and one other man stayed behind. Stewart's illness kept them in place for another 7 weeks. During that time, the brothers witnessed several skirmishes between immigrants who were headed west and natives who stole their horses, and he always attributed it to the carelessness of the immigrants. At one point, a trapper camped near their camp was accused of working in conjunction with the Indians to steal horses. But the brothers defended him, and it was this man, Jake Meek, that ended up accompanying them when Granville was ready to travel again. It was also during 7 weeks that Granville was sick that a conflict brewed not far from where the brothers were camped between Brigham Young and the U.S. government. Young had threatened to have his Mormon followers in Utah secede from the Union, and they were preparing for battle. The massacre at Mountain Meadows, where Mormon militia murdered over 100 immigrants, actually took place during this time. So this was one more reason that the brothers had no desire to stay where they were. But travel was dangerous. Together with Meek, they decided to take the risk. And that's when they ended up near present-day Dillon. Granville and James seemed to have a strong bond because they shared nearly every business venture for the entirety of their lives before James developed a liver disease and died in 1873. But Stewart often seemed to be a victim of bad timing or bad decision-making because although many of their businesses started off strong, he never managed to become a wealthy man, unlike many of his close friends, with the most notable example being Samuel Hauser, whom the brothers met in the early years in Bannock. Hauser would eventually found one of the first banks in Montana, as well as becoming one of the first governors. And although he was a loyal and often generous friend, Stewart would eventually file a lawsuit against Hauser for listing mining interests that Stewart believed belonged to him. Stewart would lose that case. Chapter 2, The First Gold Strike. In 1852, the Stewart brothers heard rumors of a gold strike near what is now Deer Lodge and decided to explore the possibility. The party explored the area of their choice of camps, determined mostly by where they could find game. Stewart writes of encountering several friendly Blackfeet in that part of the state, and although they never felt as if they were in physical danger, they knew that there was a chance that their horses could be targeted. So when they arose one morning to find some worn-out moccasins hanging in a tree nearby, they knew it was a sign that the Blackfeet had gotten away with a few of their steeds. Stewart describes scenes like this as an act of prankishness more than criminal act, as he had developed an ease with most native tribes based on his many years of treating them with mutual respect. There was a rumor that a man named Bennett C. had discovered a small amount of gold dust in a tiny creek. So Stewart and his brother had still not given up on the possibility of finding gold. They started panning in that creek and are now credited with the first substantial discovery of gold in Montana. Stewart's account of the next few years when he and his brother and other acquaintances did whatever they could to feed themselves include witnessing the murder of a mule train driver by an angry passenger, another murder in a nearby camp of a young man who had spent the night camping with them before, and his first encounter with a Pony Express rider. Stewart extols the men who took on this job with reverence, writing, "I want to say right here that for nerve, courage, and fidelity, there never was a body of men who excelled the Pony Express drivers." According to Stewart, none of these men who were supposed to deliver their cargo within a designated time ever arrived late. By May of 1858, the brothers came up with a plan to kill enough game to provide meat that they would dry and gather to sell to local trappers and prospectors, along with some horses. They planned to use this money to buy mining equipment to revisit the place where they had struck gold. The Stewarts eventually settled near present-day Deer Lodge, where Johnny Grant had already established what would become the largest cattle ranch in Montana, the Grant Coors Ranch. For the next several years, they established a friendly relationship with their neighbors, as well as with travels, which included members of many tribes in Montana. Stewart shares that they were always willing to share what they had with these travelers, and that if a band of natives needed supplies but didn't have money, they willingly provided them, knowing they would always come back and pay later, which they always did. He also tells a wonderful story about a rumor that there was a man who had come into the Bitterroot Valley with a huge trunk full of books. Granville and James, who were avid readers but didn't have room to carry books with them, packed their horses and traveled 150 miles, crossing three major rivers, to find this man. To their dismay, they learned that the man had left the area and had left the books in possession of another man with the promise that he wouldn't sell them. After much pleading and explaining how far they had traveled, they finally convinced the man to sell them five books for $5 apiece, an exorbitant sum at the time. These five books were collections by Shakespeare and Byron, a biography of Napoleon, a French Bible, and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. Stuart's Journal is also a good example, and I've read several, where men in the early days when the West was settled wrote very honestly about how lonesome it could get, which has always led me to believe that the myth about the stoicism of men in the West was created later, much of it through the early Western films, which usually weren't made by people from the West. This is a trend that has never stopped. Stuart wrote openly about how much he missed his brother James when the two of them were separated, such as a month James spent going off to gather supplies while Granville stayed home at their place near Deer Lodge. There were plenty of Indians roaming around the region during this time, especially Bannocks and Flatheads, who would often steal horses from each other and occasionally get into fatal skirmishes because of it. The Stuarts tried to stay out of these conflicts, but they sometimes got involved with the aftermath, particularly one instance where they ended up providing shelter for the wives of a murder victim. Because there were so few women in the region, it was not unusual for these lonely men to marry a native woman, and in this case, James ended up marrying one of the widows of the murdered Bannock man. It was just 2 months later that Granville married himself to a Shoshone girl, Aboni Tukonka, who was only 12 years old. Sadly, this was not unusual during these times, although Stuart would stay married to this woman for 26 years, fathering 11 children. But I'll talk more about that later. In March of 1862, a man named Tin Cup Joe charged another man, Baron O'Keefe, with killing one of his horses. O'Keefe chose to defend himself, and a massive brawl broke out when Baron O'Keefe took offense to something one of the witnesses said. Once the dust settled, O'Keefe was found guilty, and I guess it's not surprising that this is how the first trial in Montana played out. It was also during this time that the Stuarts were hit with one of the many misfortunes that always seemed to hinder whatever progress they made. The two made a big order for supplies to continue their mining operations, and James rode to Fort Benton where the steamboats arrived from back east with these orders. When James got to Fort Benton, he learned that the steamboat had exploded, thanks to a deckhand who had gone down into the hold to steal some whiskey from an order placed by one of the local mercantile stores. The deckhand had bored a hole in one of the whiskey barrels, not realizing that the candle he held in his other hand would ignite the alcohol, starting a huge fire, which then ignited a huge payload of dynamite. Thankfully, once the fire started, the ship was evacuated, so nobody was killed. But all of Stuart's supplies, as well as those of countless others, were lost. Chapter 3, The Bannock Years. After spending several years making a modest living raising cattle and panning for gold near Deer Lodge, the Stuart brothers heard reports from more and more people about a gold strike that seemed to be making a lot of people money down in the Beaverhead Valley, where they had lived when they first arrived. After years of breaking their backs trying to make a go at mining, when it looked as if this discovery was legitimate, they decided to try and profit from this gold strike peripherally by opening a butcher shop in Bannock, which was growing exponentially. In November of 1862, they loaded their wagons with as much cargo as they could and made their way to the Beaverhead Valley. They had contracted for the building to be ready by the time they arrived, so they opened for business the next day. The story of Bannock is well known to most Montanans as the early gold rush brought in a huge influx of people within the first year. And because the West was still so raw, and because they had established no infrastructure, the atmosphere was extremely unstable. It was basically a man camp, with men living in shelters made of branches and mud, or in tents. Because they had lived there earlier, the Stuarts drew immediate respect from most of the community, but Stuart points out that there were many unsavory characters that showed up in the region, so there was an underlying sense of danger. It was standard to go out in public with a gun. But there was also a certain orderliness that was honored in those early days, in large part because there was only about 30 white women in a town that was exploding. So whenever they held a dance, nobody was allowed in if they had been drinking, which is not a problem for the Stuart brothers, who never took a drink. Because there were usually about 10 men for every woman, the women danced every dance. The demand for supplies was such that Granville was able to sell shovels for $10 and a pound of tobacco for $15. The Stuarts had made around $3,000 after only 5 months in Bannock, And as things became more dangerous, Granville decided to temporarily close up shop and head back to Deer Lodge for a while. Stuart knew that if he left town with that much money, he might be putting his life in jeopardy. So he told no one and saddled up his horse very early one morning, leaving before dawn. Still, about the time he approached Deer Lodge, he was overtaken by three men he knew from Bannock to be rough characters, one of whom was later hanged by the vigilantes. But it was Stuart's good fortune that an old friend happened to come along around the same time. So the two men traveled together and kept the potential robbers at bay, probably saving Stuart's life. Stuart relates several other stories where he and or his brother came close to getting killed. And it was clear that much of the reason they survived was because they had such a steady temperament and always tried to reason with whoever they came into conflict with, especially the Indians. But not everyone was so lucky. He tells a story of a group of miners who had managed to accumulate $25,000 worth of gold dust and were planning to head south. The Stuarts warned them not to make a big show of their departure, but these guys didn't seem too interested. The Stuarts later found out that the party was traveling by boat and were attacked by Indians and killed, but that when the Indians opened the bags, they didn't know what gold was, so they dumped the gold out on the banks of the river. They saved the bags because they thought they would be useful. The gold rush in Bannock proved to be just a warm-up for what was about to come when a huge strike was discovered at Alder Gulch. Soon, another town sprung up, at first called Varina in honor of the wife of Jefferson Davis. But the postmaster of the town was not a fan of Mr. Davis, so he changed the name to Virginia City, which stuck but also provided some confusion for years to come, as there was already a Virginia City in Nevada. The Stuart brothers once again saw an opportunity and quickly built a blacksmith shop and a general store in Virginia City. Granville also played a role in creating one of the most significant organizations ever created in Montana, the Montana Historical Society, serving as its first secretary. Oddly enough, Stuart makes almost no mention in his memoir about the most dramatic events that happened while he was in Virginia City, which was the hanging of Henry Plummer and his deputies. The closest he comes is when he talks about the death of Thomas Dimmesdale, the editor of the local newspaper who also wrote The Vigilantes of Montana. Stuart makes sure to mention that Dimmesdale's account of the events was extremely accurate, even though many have proved otherwise since. Particularly Frederick Allen's outstanding book, A Decent Orderly Lynching. But Stuart clearly supported the actions of his fellow citizens, and in later years he would take his own vengeful actions under the banner of vigilantism. Chapter 4, Cattle. In 1870, L. E. Graham and J. B. Taylor arrived in Deer Lodge with 450 head of Durham cattle. This was the first herd of purebred cattle ever to come into Montana. Although the Stuarts had been involved in the cattle industry from the time they arrived, like many of their efforts, it had never been very profitable. But when the gold rush started to peter out, Granville was working as a bookkeeper in his old friend Samuel Hauser's bank in Helena. Stuart had been keeping an eye on the growing cattle business, and he became convinced that this was the next promising industry. He persuaded Hauser to go into business with him on a cattle operation. Hauser brought in another Helena banker, Andrew Davis, and he also loaned Stuart $20,000 for his share of what would become known as the DHS Cattle Company. Hauser and Davis agreed that Stuart would manage the operation, and because this was the open range period of cattle ranching, there were few actual ranches. So a lot of what ranchers depended on was finding the best grassland, especially for the winters. Once these men accumulated nearly 10,000 head of cattle, Granville decided to travel around the state to find the best home base for their operation. Along with a few of his cattlemen buddies, he proceeded to tour much of what is now Montana, making his way to the Powder River region, then up to Miles City and across the middle of the state, doing an extensive study of the water and grassland in each part he visited. There always seemed to be something that was a little off, whether it was bad water or not enough shelter or inadequate grasslands. Stuart finally settled on a tract of land that fit every one of his qualifications just north of present-day Lewistown in the Judith Basin. But there was a complication. The land was close to Fort Maginnis, which was attractive to Stuart because the presence of the military would provide protection from the local natives, as well as a ready-made market for their beef. The problem was that the army had also laid claim to the hayfields surrounding the fort. After resisting any kind of deal with the cattlemen for several years, the army finally relented in 1882, surrendering the hayfields to the DHS Cattle Company. For several years, it seemed that Stuart had finally made a sound business decision, getting into the cattle business at just the right time. But a few factors started to threaten that success. First, more and more sheepmen moved into the region. Second, the railroads moved into the area as well, providing easier access for more and more settlers. This also proved to bring in a whole lot more rustlers, and it soon became apparent that something needed to be done to address this issue. Stuart attended the meeting of the Montana Stock Growers Association in Miles City in 1883, where 279 members showed up. Although there was much pomp and circumstance at this event, when it came time to discuss business, they quickly turned their attention toward the main issue that was troubling most of these ranchers, which were the rustlers. The association decided to designate and pay a detective in each county to track down and arrest these rustlers. So for the next couple of years, the local ranchers worked together with these detectives to try and keep the rustlers at bay, especially during the roundups. Stuart does a wonderful job of describing how the roundups operated and how the big operators worked together during these roundups. He also points out that the big Montana operators, unlike their contemporaries in Wyoming, made no effort to keep out small ranchers or immigrants. And in fact, they would go out of their way to help newcomers if it was clear they needed it. It was during the two-year period of 1880 through 1882 that thousands of cattle made their way into Montana as word got out about the quality of the grassland. So the growth was almost out of control, as was the abuse of the grasslands. In 1880, Stuart estimates about 250,000 head of cattle in Montana. By 1882, that number had grown to almost 600,000. As the newcomers came pouring in, whenever there was enough children in a new ranching community, Stuart provided a schoolhouse and hired a teacher for the new school, a move that would eventually lead to him finding a second wife. Stuart also gives a fabulous description of a typical cowpuncher from that period. He points out that most of the stereotypes of loud, boastful men aren't accurate. He describes these men as being respectful toward women and singing to the cattle when they are out on watch, as well as being steady and dependable, which fits with what I saw on my own grandparents' ranch as a kid. They were also very familiar with how to operate as a team during the roundups. But during the roundup of 1883, Stuart and his fellow cattlemen estimated a 3% loss to rustlers. The thieves had become more and more organized, gathering the stolen livestock and moving it across the border to Canada. At the next stock growers meeting, where Stuart became president of the organization, they discussed how to deal with the increase. And after a spirited discussion, they voted against taking any kind of vigilante approach. Stuart voted against it, much to the dismay of some of his fellow stock growers. The rustlers were thrilled to hear this news and took advantage of the decision to increase their activities. Without saying exactly how involved he was, William talks openly in his memoir about the fact that finally, many of the cattlemen took matters into their own hands. But it became well known that Stuart was the leader of this effort, and the group even became known as Stuart's Stranglers. They are estimated to have hung between 15 and 75 men, and he's unapologetic about it, showing just how convinced they were that this was necessary. And although it did slow the activities of the rustlers, it never fully stopped them. In 1885, Stuart and his partners, which now included the famous Coors Ranch, owned almost 40,000 head of cattle. Thanks to heavy moisture that year, this influx of cattle as well as sheep had continued to the point where the range became very crowded. Business was good, but these entrepreneurs quickly learned, as many others have over time, about ranching in Montana. The summer of 1886 was hot and dry, and because of the overcrowding caused by the newcomers, the cattle were weaker than usual. The year came to a dramatic end when 1886 turned out to be the worst winter in the history of the state. Stuart recorded temperatures as low as 64 degrees below zero, with deep, heavy snow. The overgrazed pastures prevented the snow from gathering, so it blew and piled in high drifts, burying tens of thousands of livestock. Stuart and his partners lost 66% of their stock, and the average over the state was 60. Stewart would later write that he was so distraught by seeing the carnage after this winter that he had no desire to stay in the cattle business. And despite the early success of their operation, Stewart was still heavily in debt to Hauser, and this put his career as a cattleman to an end. Stewart's friend Samuel Hauser became governor about this time, and he secured Stewart an appointment as the ambassador to Uruguay and Paraguay. Upon his return from that appointment, he became the director of the library in Butte, a position he held for about 10 years. Chapter 5, Stewart's Family Life. There is no better example of how complicated Granville Stewart was than his relationship with the native community. Throughout his memoir, Stewart shows compassion and empathy for how the natives were treated during his time, and even writes about a plan that he set forth to replace the reservation system, which he considered a no-win situation for the native community, an opinion that has proven to be accurate. He talks about how horrific the government policy to slaughter the buffalo was as a way to starve out the native population. He also shows an uncommon understanding of each tribe's dynamics and how they played off each other. He knew these people, traded with them, even married one. But of course, we need to remember that this woman was only 12 years old when she became his wife. When Montana came into being, Stewart even suggested an Indian name for the state, Toyabe Shakup, which is Shoshone for mountainous. But in Stewart's later years, he fell in love with Alice Bell Brown, one of the teachers he had hired for the schools near Deer Lodge, and he married her, leaving his first wife with their 11 children. Of course, it's impossible to know what was going on in the personal lives of these people, but by most accounts, Stewart had very little contact with his children after his second marriage. He shipped most of them to boarding schools. Stewart talks very little about his personal life in his journals, and almost never about his family. The only time Albani's name is mentioned is in an entry from James, who often wrote in Granville's journal, in an entry announcing that Granville had gotten married. Granville himself mentions his wife only a handful of times, and only as my wife, and always just in passing, mostly saying she accompanied him somewhere. He never talks about any event involving her, and I don't recall a single mention of his children, which is fascinating, considering there were 11 of them. Stewart's journals were voluminous, thousands of pages, so it's entirely possible that whoever compiled the collection chose to exclude any mention of the family, but it seems unlikely that of all the stories they chose, they would decide to exclude every single one that involves a family member. It's probably more likely that Stewart's journal, as thorough and exacting and fascinating as it is also a very good indication of how much the early West was very much a man's world. The women, as few of them as there were meant to serve. And the fact that Albani was a native might have made her a perfect companion for Stewart in that regard. But that's one thing we will never know for sure. You've been listening to 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. I'm your host, Russell Rowland, and I've been talking about the man known as Mr. Montana, Granville Stewart. You can listen to this or any other episode of 56 Counties on ypr.org, and please show your support for public radio as we have faced unprecedented budget cuts. Join me again on the first Monday of each month for another episode of 56 Counties here on Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm going.